to Must See IMDb, a podcast where we break down a classic TV show and then we must discuss. Is the number one top-rated IMDb voted episode truly the best? Or are there some hidden gems that need a boost up that list? I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. As kids, we watched a ridiculous amount of television and continue to do so right through to today. We watch, we discuss, and now we are heading down to the Southern Hemisphere to chat about
Miss Fisher's murder mysteries.
Oh my gosh, Abby, IMDb perfectly describes the show in like two sentences. A female sleuth sashays through the back lanes and jazz clubs of Melbourne in the late 1920s, fighting injustice with her pearl-handled pistol and her dagger-sharp wit.
Brilliantly summed up. Franny Fisher, she's a privileged white lady, let's be clear. And boy, does she have a cast of characters that support her every step of the way. I do appreciate how much she appreciates each of them. It's not like she's oblivious to the fact that she could not be who she was if she didn't have this cast of characters around her.
Entourage, Abby. She has an entourage. You can't go without further discussion before mentioning Dot. So this is, you know, 1928, I think, is when the series starts. Dot is pretty much the first mystery that she solves whilst in Australia. She is a lady's companion, a maid, who swiftly becomes basically her assistant detective.
I would say the Watson to her Sherlock, as she does live at 221B.
She does. And they are the odd couple. So Franny Fisher is a modern woman. She's got the jazz age look. She's a flapper to the nth degree. She's modern about women's roles in society. She's modern about sex in her life. She's modern about not wanting to be married or to have children, to be an independent soul. Whereas Dot comes from a very Catholic upbringing, is at the beginning, shocked by pretty much everything that she sees.
In the first episode, she doesn't want to answer the telephone for fear of being electrocuted because the telephone is too modern and new.
So I was reading up on 1920s Australia, and electricity was just coming to Melbourne at that time. It was a little bit behind, say, the United States. So yes, that was a true thing where people were like terrified of it. So it's a good dichotomy where slowly we see Dot loosening up a bit, but she's still the moral backbone of the two. Friday has no problems breaking rules left, right, and center.
I'm then going to move on to our male character cornerstone of the series. This is Detective Jack Robinson, played by Nathan Page, who it's amazing to see how Detective Jack Robinson also changes over the series. From the beginning, you've got your typical disgruntled detective who does not want Franny messing with his cases, is constantly annoyed that she's around. By the third season, not only are they like quasi-dating, but they just genuinely take joy in one another. Also, there's great cases where he gets excluded from solving the case in various different ways. And so then they're like teaming up to break the rules. So it's wonderful to see his trajectory as well. We also have to mention here that this series is based on the books written by Carrie Greenwood, and the Jack Robinson character is completely different from the books.
Wildly different. In fact, there's a main love interest that we barely see on this show. Who is her main love interest in the books? Yeah, but this was a really good adaptation. It's visual candy because she's rich, so she's got an amazing house. And the clothing, I'm sure we'll talk for 500 hours about the clothing. Okay, but moving on, there's one more male character that I really love in this series, Constable Collins. So just like Franny has Dot, Jack Robinson has Constable Collins, who throughout the course of the show provides comedy relief in pretty much every episode because he's kind of like just trying to keep up with everybody else. And at the beginning, especially in series one, where Jack is not wanting Franny anywhere around, Collins is so flabbergasted by her power that he accidentally gives away the information that she needs.
And he's played by Hugo Johnston Burt, who has, we've talked about this before, an elastic face. So he's doing eyebrows. He's doing lip stuff. He's doing all this sort of befuddled fumbling quite a bit, which, as you said, provides comic relief. But also, both Jack Robinson and Hugh Collins are trying to figure out how to handle these modern women. Hugh wants a typical 1920s housewife, but is falling in love with Dot. And then you've got Jack trying to juggle Franny. And it's interesting to see the way the two of them both handle that.
You're right. And we get to see their relationships develop in real time. And it's kind of like Hugh and Dot are like sweet and sour sauce. And Jack and Franny are like sriracha. And it's so fun to watch both sets fall in love.
Now we have to move on to Bert and Cess, who also show up in the first episode. And basically, they're men of all work for Franny. They drive a cab, but Franny hires them on to do all kinds of reconnaissance work, following people, checking into things, going down to the docks, making their way into spaces where she would be much more conspicuous. Correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like Bert is a little bit more of a main character than Cess, but usually the two of them are together, and they too are hilarious at times.
Yeah, they have little tiny, you know, one-offs that can be fun to watch, like Bert hating this guy because he knows he can be hypnotized by him and then getting hypnotized. They can totally steal the show with their little quirks and stuff that come up in these investigations.
Also, there's some really heart-rendering scenes. For example, we're about to talk about Aunt Prudence, I'm sure. But there's a thing where she's grieving the loss of a child and she's refusing to sort of ever talk about his existence. And Bert finally goes to her.
This is a home, not a fortress, Albert. People will just have to learn to behave.
Can't be helping your peace of mind. Still wandering the halls in your nightdress like the lady in white.
Oh, thank you not to mention that to anyone. Most especially not to my niece.
You were looking for scallop pies. Arthur's favourite.
I was talking nonsense. It was a bad dream, that's all. And I don't want you discussing my son.
You know, losing mates in the war was bad enough. But pretending they never existed, that's plain wrong.
And he basically is the one who breaks through to this battle axe Aunt Prudence. And so sometimes they can really be like that arrow straight to your heart as well. And I have to say, I just love Bert so much.
Yeah, the cast on this show, I mean, they all do their jobs really well, but sometimes they have to do something that you're not used to seeing from their character, which makes this show sing. And in keeping with that, kind of the final part of Franny's entourage is Mr. Butler, who is her butler. And what I love is that in the second episode, she's setting up kind of her house in Australia. And this very prim, proper Mr. Butler is like scuttling about getting ready. Bert and Cess have met Miss Franny and are like, oh man, he's going to lose it when he sees who he's having to serve.
You must be Mr. Johnson and Mr. Yates. I'm Tobias Butler.
G'day.
I thought you'd be wanting some refreshment before you pick up the rest of the furniture. Please. I haven't worked for a spinster before.
Spinster? Have you met Miss Fisher?
I understand she's related to the king. Mrs. Butler would have loved that.
She's certainly a top.
Well, it'll be a pleasure to serve a respectable lady with a strict routine who appreciates the quiet life.
She shows up. She's clearly this modern woman.
And you must be Mr. Butler.
Pleased to meet you, Miss Fisher.
Sorry, I forgot to telephone ahead about my extra guests. We've all been somewhat distracted by Eunice's mother's murder.
A murder, miss?
I do hope they chloroformed her first, but hanging's never pleasant. Keep your eye on this one. She's a stowaway, a thief, and probably needs delousing. I expect the police will come looking for her, but you can just refer them to me. Oh, and while I remember, careful with the hand luggage. My pistol's in there somewhere, and it may still be loaded.
Of course, miss. Appreciate the warning.
And he's like, sure, ma'am, no problem. And Bert and Cess are like, wait, what? I mean, later on, he's like pulling out AK-47 that they can have because he used to be a military guy.
Also, he and Dot have a really fun relationship. There's one episode where Dot is getting upset because her priest is not happy that she's dating Hugh. And then Mr. Butler is gently leading her down the path of, aren't you basically setting up everything for their fundraisers? Pointing out to her like how she has power that she does not herself see. So he's a fantastic source of wisdom and feminism in the household.
Yeah. You feel safe with these people because you know that at the end of the day, somebody's going to save somebody else's tuchus and it's going to be real fun to watch.
Yes, now we need to move on to Aunt Prudence, who I think we can sum up by simply saying she's played by Miriam Margolyes, full stop.
Well, she's quite the gem. And like I said, this cast is one to die for. And many people on this show die.
We always see the murder before the opening credits. That's the deal. But these murders are really freaking gruesome most of the time. And then it's immediately followed by the opening credits, which I'm going to play a little clip. To bring you down from the adrenaline rush of just seeing something absolutely gruesome and horrible flash before your eyes.
Yes, a decapitated head just rolled across the stage. Let's hit the music.
Yeah, and you know those in mummification, they like shove a big thing up your nose to pull your brain out?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the person is alive while it's happening.
Cue music. But I will say that song is so jaunty. It's one of those ones where I don't fast forward these credits because I love that song so much.
Yeah, it's good stuff. All right. So the IMDb voters have selected a number one episode from season one, episode 12, Murder in the Dark. So this is the penultimate episode of the season, and it's sort of a to be continued. So it's like the part one of the finale, and also crickets as to why this was selected by the
Yeah.
IMDb voters.
This was like, okay, I get it if you're going to do the final episode like you always do, but this was the worst out of all of the ones that I watched.
Okay, so I was trying to figure this out and I did a little research. Murder in the Dark is one of the Cary Greenwood actual novels that they turned into the show. And I think the first problem is that in the book, it's these two Parisian old friends of Phryne that are holding this enormous costume party, and shenanigans go down from there. The problem with the show is that they set up this entire backstory for why Phryne might want to be solving mysteries involving her sister being murdered when they were children. And this backstory does not ever happen in the books. And I kind of don't like that it happens in the show, but the IMDb voters seem to love it.
Yeah, it's shoehorned in and it kind of takes over, especially the end of series one.
I feel like this idea was blossomed in a writer's room where they were unhappy with it just being episodic television, and they felt they had to have some sort of overarching umbrella for each season to tally-ho further into their personal lives. And I think this one is just a miss because I think it makes Phryne more powerful, that she's smart, she's capable, she's just a bored society woman who has the skills to do this, so she does it. It's none of this. My sister was abducted, and then sometimes it doesn't even make sense. I like the character of Cousin Arthur, who has cerebral palsy, but I don't like that they're trying to make it seem like maybe he's the one that murdered Phryne's sister. Phryne also now has a young ward who's a girl who's about 14 named Jane. Oh, Phryne's dead sister was named Janie. It just seems to go on and on trying to connect this with her past. I'll just say the bad guy's name is Murdoch Foyle. Many people on the internet have pointed out that there's the Murdoch Mysteries, and then there's also Foyle's War. We've talked about that before because what's his name writes it.
Anthony Horowitz.
Thank you. And that basically they took the names of those two other mystery series, smushed them together, and made a bad guy. And I'm not digging it.
Yeah, it's tepid tea at best.
And then they pull a MacGyver in the finale of this, which is the next episode. We've been led to believe this is a Hannibal Lecter type person, and then he turns into a wackadoo MacGyver caricature villain who's into Egyptology mummification bullshit and wants to just take the brains out of people and have women sacrifice themselves to him because he thinks he's some dead Egyptian god and he needs women to come with him into the afterlife so he'll have all these wives?
Yeah, but it is a top 10 episode according to IMDb, and I happily skipped that one. Basically, I hung out in season two, and here's the reason why. In season one, you've got all these ridiculous serial killer Murdoch guy stuff that I could give two craps about. Also, I like it so much better when Jack gets off his hard-nosed misogyny and is like, oh, wow, this woman keeps solving these mysteries. By season two, he's figured out they're so much better when they're working together than when there's this false animosity, just to allow Friday to break all these rules.
One thing that I'm sure you and I will talk about when we do get to our favorite episodes is that this is an episode that highlights a lot of people. So everyone, you know, has a moment in this one because there is this huge costume party. Part of me wondered if it was a fashion thing, because when you get to this costume party, not only is Phryne going as Cleopatra, but you've also got this ridiculous cousin going as Lady Godiva, or maybe Eve. She's basically naked. And you have Bert and Sess trying to be like footmen for Aunt Prudence. And you have Mr. Butler. Basically, they all become Aunt Prudence's staff because her staff has basically been murdered off.
Yeah, it's like a Gatsby party. I get it. That's exciting. And also, it's really well done at the end where you think bad crap is going to happen in the last 2 minutes of this episode, and then Mr. Butler, unbeknownst to himself, saves the day.
Still not into it. Boo, IMDb voters. Go do a rewatch and vote for something else.
I barely watched any of the top 10 episodes. I have like six that I am wringing my hands trying to figure out which is the best, and none of them are in the top 10.
All right, that's fair. Now, I will say there were two other episodes that are right up there at the top. They just had fewer voters. And I did notice a theme. This top one is essentially the beginning of the end of season one. Then you also have the end of season two. And then you also have season three's series finale vying for those top things. So I still feel like it's that traditional season conclusion type episode that was wooing the voters. Can I actually take this moment to just do a quick shout out for my favorite Phryne Fisher novel, which was sadly never turned into an episode. It's novel number 8. It's called Urn Burial. Now, Lin Chung only shows up in a couple of episodes. He's this kind of man about Chinatown who becomes Phryne's lover. Later, he gets engaged. That does not stop them from banging. Later, he gets married. She has the new wife over. She's like, listen, I'm still going to be banging your husband. All of this is going down in the books. And he's in a scant 2 episodes of the show. But my favorite novel is where she takes Lin as her date to this like house party. It's very Agatha Christie. We're all in a secluded house. There's like hidden passages and caves underneath the grounds. And then it turns out that the author revealed she wrote it as an homage to a Miss Marple mystery, because readers were very confused as to how Phryne was acting in the beginning, where she was ordering Dot around like a maid, which is something that Phryne would never do to Dot, but it's totally something Miss Marple would do because she trains maids on how to do the job. Anyways, it's a wonderful book. I loved it so much. So if you want to get a little more Agatha with Phryne, I highly recommend reading that. But alas, it's not in the series.
So I love the Lin Chung character, and I love how gray their relationship is. And I just did not like how the TV series dealt with it. First of all, the guy that plays him looks like he's maybe 12. And what I liked about Lin in the books is Lin is not a younger man to be manipulated. He is just as strong. He's a silk importer. He's rich. He doesn't need Phryne's money. He doesn't need anything from her. He's like toe-to-toe with her in those books. And he's not treated that way in the TV show. He's younger. He's almost treated as another quote-unquote boy toy for her to flirt with just to make Jack jealous, basically. And I didn't like that because I loved that part of the books.
One episode that deals with it in the series that I actually loved. Season 1, episode 8, Away with the Fairies. And his bride-to-be shows up. His domineering matriarchal grandmother immediately dislikes this wife who has come to marry Lin Chung. And therefore, Franny Fisher has to take her into her house. She's constantly taking in the riffraff. And Lin Chung is like, hey, you got to deal with her here because my grandma doesn't like this woman who was supposed to be this sort of beautiful,
virgin,
accommodating, obeying wife. Okay. Franny quickly does a little reconnaissance and discovers this woman is for sure a communist and is like helping lead the revolution in China. It's then revealed that she totally knows English, fully educated. She's not a virgin. She's a widow. She's also a modern woman. Now, what I love about how the show, once it recognizes that about this woman who's come into Lin's life, she and Franny go kick some ass
together.
Yeah. And then when Lin is finally like, back off, grandma, I'm going to marry this woman, Franny like literally pulls a Hugh Collins, does a little face and like tiptoes unelegantly from the room. I understand what you're saying about the grayness of the relationship in the novels, but I loved how the series, clearly they weren't going to keep Lin around. So I loved how they had Franny kind of back off and let those two characters be.
I agree with that. But the one place where I disagree with you is I loved Lin's new wife too. Kick-ass, strong woman. But what I don't like about her is that she's not in love with Lin. Like, she's literally just trying to escape her family, who will kill her because of her revolutionary ways. She has no stake in the game with Lin other than the fact that he can protect her. You know, what do I get out of this other than protection?
All right, so you were debating between six episodes. Which one did you select?
Oh God, Abby, I'm still debating. I'm still thinking this through.
All right, well, I'll wax poetic while you continue to think. My favorite episode, which I texted you this morning because I was like, oh no, you're going to need to watch this right now. Oh my gosh, I saw it this morning and I was like, nope, this is the winner. I love this one so much. You've already mentioned the decapitated head. But a woman in a magic show is literally guillotined her head off in front of you. You see the whole thing, as do Dottie, Bert, and Sess in this magic show. It's horrifying. And that begins this magic show theater mystery that now must be solved. It's incredible.
Okay, Abby, you made me watch it. And I was like struggling with six episodes. And then I was like, oh, crap. Because this one's really good.
This one is so fun. I feel like whenever there's a show or a jazz club or, you know, some little gimmicky thing, it ups the fun of the mystery tenfold. And that for sure happens here. Now, subplot, we also have Franny's deadbeat dad coming back to Melbourne, which is throwing the kinks in the works of Franny and Jack. It's like they're not saying they're in a relationship. You see that in the beginning. She keeps trying to have this date with Jack. It keeps getting canceled because she's got this mysterious house guest that he thinks is just another one of, quote,
but I don't want you to think I'm like all those other liberal-minded men.
What other men?
Well, the parade, the constant parade of French artists, of fugitive anarchists, of Russian clairvoyants, of the tango dancers, and men who wear damned cravats. Well, I'm not one of them, and I never will be, even if you want me to be. That's all I have to say.
Meanwhile, it's like her dad, but she isn't telling him that. But the other reason, Katie, is because, let's be honest, there are twins masquerading as the other twin in this one, and that's the key to the crime.
Oh, I noted that. I was like, oh, they're twins. Okay, this is going to be one of those twin mysteries.
Now, later we're going to talk about our favorite fashion of the series.
Well, this episode is a doozy.
This one gets high marks. Every outfit that Franny wears is kismet. And of course, does she have to end up performing in the magic act as a mermaid in like a sequined 1920s swimming costume? And before she performs, is there a homage to those old movies where there's the famous director who did all of those?
Yeah, like I'm gonna know the director, please.
The director was Busby Berkeley, who often worked with Esther Williams on these synchronized swimming films.
FYI, this was my favorite fashion episode, because right off the bat, when the entire cast is getting questioned by Detective Inspector Robinson, I was like, holy shirt monkeys, there is Bugsy Malone's Fat Sam's Grand Slam women dancers in the exact same outfits, which is like boy shorts made out of silver sequins, with a little like crop top, also made out of silver sequins, but this one ups the ante with this like bodice with all these blues and greens done in like a tulle. I'm just like, damn, this episode was hands down the best fashion episode. The mermaid costume, it's like these art deco panels of fish scales done in gold. I mean, it's just flippin' insane. Oh, did we not mention that the mermaid magic thing that she's got to do is one of those Houdini things where you get thrown into a chained tank and then you have to escape somehow? This entire show, like Abby was saying, is just one crazy costume after the other. And that brocaded jacket is a light blue with embroidered hummingbirds all over it. Hands down, the best flipping coat. And the coats, can I just say, are like half the reason to watch this show. The end. I'm sorry, I'm done. Keep going.
Oh, one other outfit I have to mention from this episode. She's wearing this kind of mermaid colored, it's cream, but it's got iridescent blue and greens chiffon. It's a full length coat. It's very mermaidy, which is, you know, foreshadowing that she's going to become a mermaid.
Yeah, and you sent me like an amazing gallery of images of the costume designer. Who is the costume designer?
Marion Boyce is the costume designer, and we'll link several places you can find her work in the show notes.
That woman is a genius. But what makes these items of clothing is how they move. You've got to watch the shows because you see how this amazing fabric just wraps people's bodies and then moves as they walk, and it's amazing.
There is this blog that Katie is referencing that I sent her called Phryne's Fabulous Frocks. I will put it in the show notes. Go get a cup of tea and sit for 2 to 3 hours looking at every costume that was designed for this show because they are all incredible. This is very hard marks on the fashion, but the reason it's my favorite episode is that you also finally have Dot coming into her own as an investigator. She is the one who goes back to the place where they met the not actually dead twin and realizing that something's wrong. Now, the old Dot would have been like, this is suspicious. I better go get Phryne. But the third season Dot whips out some lock picks of her own and enters the building. Also, Hugh is being, I'm just gonna say it, a d in this episode about her helping investigate. He's turned into like Jack from season one. Dot is also not having that. At the end, she actually says to Hugh,
"Good teamwork, Hugh."
When clearly she freaking did everything. Hugh needs to shape up in the third season, and he finally does.
Well, there's a great episode in season two, I think, and it's right after he proposes, and then he's like, "Oh, and by the way, when are you quitting, Miss Fisher? Because you know, like now you've got to be in charge of our household." And she's like, "Say but." And then he goes to Jack for advice.
"What's going on, Collins? We've had another murder, sir."
"Oh, I meant Miss Williams."
"I always thought, sir, that when Dottie and I set a date, assuming she agreed, she'd stop working for Miss Fisher and make a home for us both. I thought she'd be happy to. But now it seems that she doesn't want to stop working. And she's not happy."
"What you're experiencing, Collins, is the paradox of pursuing a modern woman."
"Dottie's a modern woman?"
"Well, she's been living with one for a while. It's bound to rub off."
And then at the end, there's a cute toast.
"I would like to propose a toast to two of the dearest people I know. To Dot, my rock of Gibraltar, my strong right hand. And of course, to Hugh, that purveyor of quiet yet irresistible constabulary charm. To Dot and Hugh."
"To Dot and Hugh."
Hugh can try to be the strong man or whatever, but since Dottie's half the time whacking criminals with her purse to help him get away, he realizes that he needs to like put those ideas behind him.
Yeah, and I actually like that it takes Hugh's character a while to get there because, as you say, that happens in season two. He is still wrestling with this up to basically the end of the series. I think that's just true. I like that this show is like, nope, this is still a problem. We're going to be slowly working through.
Yes, and I liked that even on the first episode where they have this issue, they're talking at the end and she takes back the engagement and she's like, "Okay, fine." But she's like, "But how are we going to figure this out?"
"But how will we solve everything?"
"It's a paradox, Dottie. Problem that takes time to solve. Time for me to understand the modern woman.
So you're happy for a long engagement then?
I'm happy.
Me too.
I like that the dialogue acknowledges that, as any real relationship does, that you got to work through this crap.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So Dot's being amazing. Friday turns into our mermaid. You realize the evil twin is the baddie, and the evil twin is locked Friday in this water tank. So now you're like, oh no. Dot, Jack, and Hugh are rushing to her rescue as the minutes tick by. Jack rushes on stage with an axe to break the tank, but it's revealed Friday totally let herself out several minutes ago, because of course she had hidden lockpicks in her bra, because she doesn't trust anybody to handle things.
Yes, we don't have a damsel in distress ever on this show.
So that's my favorite episode. It's an adrenaline rush from the beheading to the final credits.
Okay, so the like six that I was torn between, kind of like the Chandler and Monica of this show for me, are Dot and Hugh. So I loved just kind of like following their relationship because it's sweet, but it has real issues in it. One of my absolute favors was Ruddy Gore, which apparently was a Gilbert and Sullivan show. So you have, you know, actors being killed, and was it the understudy trying to kill them? Part of the mystery is that people keep seeing this ghost. You, the viewer, gets to see the ghost, and it is like see-through. It's not a person dressed up. Like, you're like, how are they doing this? Every time we see the ghost, there's all this sand on the floor afterwards, and you're like, huh? That's the how are they doing this part that I loved about that mystery. Also, this is just pure camp. I mean, there's an age old, somebody died 10 years ago and now had two lovers. And who's the person in the cast that is secretly the old villain, but dressed up in a disguise? I mean, it is just so over the top with long lost fathers and daughters born out of wedlock. The other part I love about this, because it relates back to the Dot and Hugh story, is that Dot is absolutely gobsmacked by one of the actors in the show. She's like a super fan. She wants his autograph. She's got all of his posters. And now it's Hugh's turn to feel a little insecure. So Friday gives him this book of erotica, and he's like shocked and horrified. And she's like, oh, but don't forget, there's a whole chapter on kissing in here. And Hugh, good soul that he is, doesn't look at the erotica. He literally is in the police station trying to figure out how to better kiss someone so that Dot will not be in love with this, you know, theater star, but will instead be in love with him. And then at the end, they share this really cute, and may I say, more than just the peck on the cheek that he's used to giving her, kissing scene at the end.
So is Ruddy Gore your favorite?
No, having said all that, then you flippin' made me watch your magician's show one, and Abby, damn it, it's the best show of the whole darn thing.
Huzzah! Has this ever happened before?
I don't think it's ever happened that we disagree with IMDb and agree with each other.
Now, one thing I find really interesting that I'm curious about is that near the end of season 3, Hugh mentions that their wedding date is going to be September 14th, 1929. So we're literally like a month away from the big crash. I remember the feeling at the end of The Durrells in Corfu where you're like, oh gosh, World War II is a-coming.
It's about to get bad.
Yeah, and this show doesn't really address that at all, but aren't you curious to daydream about what happens with the crash? Because even in the 2020 movie, they're pretending like that still hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, money solves a crap ton of her problems. Now, can we rely, hopefully, on the fact that her wit will get her around to this? Here's hoping, but see, wouldn't that be 10 times more interesting?
They are aware of class. They are aware of how money is basically her get out of jail free card every time. And we're led to understand, as in the books, that Franny grew up dirt poor, and that's how she can understand all these different levels of the class system. There's a really interesting episode where Jane's real mom shows back up. So her ward has this mother that I think we were led to believe was dead. It turns out the mother has mental health issues and could not care for Jane. Also, because they could never find the mom, the adoption papers for Franny to officially adopt her never got signed. Kudos to Ruby Rees, plays the young Jane. Katie, she was giving me like Megan Follows vibes, our favorite Anne of Green Gables. I was so impressed with her. I feel like Jane is normally just like, I'm in braids reading a book and I'm cute. But in this episode, she ends up going to the mom to try and get the mom to sign the adoption papers because she clearly wants to stay with Franny. And at first you're like, why isn't she like so happy that her mom, you know, wants her back clearly? And the mom keeps being like, oh, just stay a little longer. Oh, I'll make cake. And then as the evening progresses, it becomes more and more clear that the mom is someone with a pretty intense mental health situation.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
It's all wrong. But why is it? Someone wants to tamper with it.
You must have used salt instead of sugar.
But I didn't. Someone's been in here.
No, they haven't.
Yes, they have. It's him. I heard him the other night. He hasn't been around here for a while. But it's a bad omen to spill salt. Do you remember Lot's wife? Remember? We've got to throw some over our shoulder.
You need some sleep. And I need to go home. They'll be worried.
You can't. It's not safe out there. Here.
Oh, I need to go. Where's the key?
It's him, Jane.
I was really struck by what an amazing portrayal that the writing was doing, that the two actresses were doing in the scenes. And at the end, you know, she's back with Franny and the mom, you see that she loves her daughter and wants what's best for her daughter, but she also wants to be with her daughter. And it creates this really tricky situation. Now, because it's episodic television, Franny has to be like,
we'll find somewhere where she's happy. And you can visit her whenever you like. I promise.
So once again, money swoops in to save the day. But I did think that they're trying to tackle mental health in a really interesting way. That episode where Aunt Prudence opens her home to this, what you think is a wackadoo hypnotist, and you think maybe he's even the murderer. But then it turns out he's the only one who doesn't believe that women are hysterical and we should be removing their uteruses left, right, and center. Again, there's like, oh, the crazy doctors in the 1920s were possibly the ones who were more progressive and actually felt like women were human beings.
Yeah, and we're deemed crazy for thinking that.
What else shall we discuss? What have you seen one of these actors do elsewhere that is your favorite?
The best thing that I've ever seen one of these cast members in is not another movie or scripted television show. It's Miriam Margolyes, you guys, Battle Axe Aunt Prudence. And all I think you need to do is go to YouTube. Some blessed soul out there has put together a 30-minute thing on every appearance that she has done on The Graham Norton Show, which is this British late-night TV talk show where the guests drink wine and try to outdo each other with crazy stories. And everybody on Miriam Margolyes' episode loses because her stories are always the craziest. And she is the most wonderful human being ever. And I love her so much. Miriam Margolyes, The Graham Norton Show people.
We will totally put a link to that YouTube clip in the show notes. All right. Mine is also Miriam Margolyes, but in something different. There is this amazing show called Miriam Margolyes, Almost Australian. And it's her in this RV driving all around Australia. It's really impressive all the different places she goes. So on one hand, it's like a travel show. You're like, ooh, this new place, that new place. But she's staying at these RV camps. This is how you learn she doesn't like children. A family shows up and she's like, oh God, kids. She meets Aboriginal people and is interacting with them. It's this incredible show. Just if you're interested in Australia in general, because she's this British woman who's lived there for decades and she's working towards finally becoming an Australian citizen. That's sort of the premise of the show. But of course, it's Miriam Margolyes being her very interesting self also the entire time. And then cherry on top, this was so popular, they made a subsequent series where let's add Alan Cumming to the mix, shall we? And they both have Scottish roots, so let's have them drive around Scotland together and explore. And that is even more fun. So Miriam Margolyes for the win. Check out everything the woman has ever done, even beyond Franny.
I would travel wherever she goes. Okay, so now we're on our desert island, Abby. Who are you taking with you to, I'm sure, sing show tunes somehow? You all seem to end up singing show tunes with whoever you take to this island.
Can you go with anyone but Phryne? I want Phryne. I would happily bask and be her entourage. Hopefully she's brought 18 trunks so that we can just play fashion show all day long while we wait for rescue. Or strap them together and make a raft or something. I would just bask in the sun that is Phryne Fisher.
Okay, so while you're having your fashion plate things in between starving to death, I'm going to take Collins. Hugh Collins, because again, have I not mentioned that he shows up and he's like, how can I help? I feel like we could build shelters together and he could, you know, maybe throw on those shorts and the tank top and go swimming for fish or something. I'm not going to complain if that happens. Hugh for the win. We'll send him back to Dottie when we're done. But yes, I would totally have him on the island.
There is that episode where they go to Queenscliff.
Oh my God, Abby, he pops out of that water and I'm like, oh, find that murder weapon, Hugh.
And you're also like, this is not historically accurate. Those large arm muscles were not what was going on in the 1920s.
All right, so is there anything that you just have to tell me about this week?
Okay, I've been sending this to everyone, including Katie. There is a YouTube clip that has quickly whipped up a couple million views in the last week or two, and it is well deserved. This is a dance troupe called CDK. They are from the Netherlands, and they basically choreographed a dance to somebody that I used to know, the Gautier song from a couple years ago. It is spellbinding. I can't say anything else. There will be a link. Go click it in the show notes. You will have an incredible 3.5 minute experience, and it will be what you're telling people about shortly thereafter.
Yes, and oh my gosh, the outfits are so perfectly coordinated and not what you typically see dancers wear, but it works very well for this song.
Yeah, perfect for this fashion theme we've got going with Phryne.
So I recently found myself in Death Valley, which, whoa, Nelly, is the most incredible, weird landscape I've ever seen in my life. And I'm feeling, I remember that movie Tremors from 1990 that you and I used to watch. So I come home, I've got my 7-year-old son at home, and I want to watch this movie so bad. So I'm trying to convince him that it will be okay to watch for movie night. My older son is a hard pass. My younger son's like, okay, I'll give it a try. I was worried at first that I had traumatized him, but after he absorbed it, he's very into this movie. So I feel like I've passed down this wonderful movie that takes place in the desert. And oh, you can totally tell that they shot it in Death Valley, some of the scenes. It stars Kevin Bacon and Fred Ward. They're kind of like Bert and Seth. They do all these odd jobs in this Nowheresville town in the middle of the desert, basically.
So what's on the agenda for today?
Garbage day.
Oh, man. Already? Hey, what's Nestor paying us?
$50. And that's $47 more than we got.
Burton had this place is closer. Let's do their linoleum today and do the garbage tomorrow.
Nestor's not home tomorrow. Now, look, we don't dig today. We don't get paid today. Now, damn it, Valentine, you never plan ahead. You never take the long view. I mean, here it is Monday, and I'm already thinking of Wednesday. It is Monday, right?
Hey, who the hell's that? That's not what's-his-name, the grad student.
Nah, he graduated. Must be the new one.
New one? That's supposed to be a girl.
And then Finn Carter shows up playing this geologist, and weird tremors are showing up on her geological instruments. And the next thing you know, this entire town is being terrorized by these like underground worm things with snakes popping out of their mouths. Anyway, I loved it. I love the setting. The cast is amazing. Reba McEntire kicks some serious worm ass. So just reliving, you know, that 1990 movie that we used to love so much.
A fabulous choice. All right, so there you have it. The IMDb voters have unfortunately selected season 1, episode 12, Murder in the Dark, as the best episode of Miss Fisher's Mysteries, but Katie and I vehemently disagree and also agree that the actual best episode is season 3, episode 1, Death Defying Feats. Now, for next time, We are continuing the train back from Australia. Forget about the oceans, people. We're on the female train and we're moving forward. We are headed this time northward to Canada, where we will be rewatching Avonlea starring a young Sarah Polley.
It's a boot time.
Grab your maple syrup and let's head up to Avonlea. All right, see you then.
Bye.